This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Collider says BritBox has TV everyone should be watching. Stream acclaimed series with powerful performances from Jodie Whittaker, Tamara Lawrence, Bella Ramsey and Matthew McFadyen. Discover new BritBox original series you won't find anywhere else. Like Three Little Birds, Agatha Christie's Murder is Easy, and a new chapter of BAFTA-winning drama, Time. Stream what the New York Times calls the best of British telly, only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, Jenny Murray welcoming you to the Woman's Hour podcast for Thursday, the 11th of June. Good morning. In 2016, a celebrated Honduran environmental activist and indigenous leader was killed after years of threats and intimidation. To research the murder of Berta Cáceres, the journalist Nina Lacani risked her own safety to find out who killed her and why. The next in our series of troopers, women who get things done, is Jackie Shimizu, who runs the Hill Station Cafe in South London. And following the route taken by Odysseus from Troy to his home island of Ithaca, Bethany Hughes and her own Greek Odyssey. Now, money. At a time when being paid for work has become uncertain and jobs are no longer as secure as they might have been, is a worry for most of us during these difficult times. But a picture seems to be emerging that shows women's personal finances are at the greatest risk. The debt advice charity Step Change warns that British households are expected to rack up debts worth a combined £6 billion because of COVID-19 as they fall behind with their bills. And it looks as if this will fall disproportionately on women. Research published this week by the Women's Budget Group and Fawcett showed that concerns about debt are particularly high among women in black and minority ethnic groups, many of whom said they were struggling to feed their children. How much money do women have? And what needs to change if finances are to improve? Well, I'm joined by Zubeda Haque, who's a member of the Independent Sage Group and interim director of the Runnymede Trust, Amy Cashman, chief executive of Kantar's Insights Division, and Jude Kelly, founder of the Women of the World Festival, who's involved in the Ensuring Women's Futures programme. Jude, I remember you saying on the programme last year that money was a feminist issue. What impact on that thinking has the pandemic had?
I hope that women will look at the hugely disproportionate impact it's having on them and realise that unless we protest, understand the facts and ensure ourselves psychologically by having a completely different attitude to our right to have money, I think we have to take this opportunity, because what the pandemic is demonstrating is that women at all levels of society are going to be affected, because they're much more likely to be doing part-time work. They're much more likely to be furloughed. If they get furloughed or they lose their jobs or they step down because of huge childcare pressures, amongst other things, their pensions are going to go further down than ever. And I'll just give you a frightening statistic. Women from black or ethnic minority groups have a 51% pension gap with an average white man. I mean, man, the gap isn't just at a pay level now, it's at a pension level much later down the line. And so why it's a feminist issue is it because it absolutely relates to the history of the idea that women's finances doesn't matter as much to society, that unpaid labour is acceptable, that low-paid labour is acceptable, and that women can go to the back of the queue whenever there's a crisis. And we have to say that's not acceptable, it mustn't happen anymore.
Zubeda, the research, as I said, published this week, highlighted the impact on BAME women. How do you reckon we got to this point?
Because what COVID-19 has shown more than anything, Jenny, is that racial inequalities have always been there. COVID-19 has brought racial inequalities and socioeconomic inequalities into sharp relief. And that's because, of course, as we've rightly mentioned, that Black and ethnic minority women and women in general have always been treated as, if you like, second-class citizens, and their work, whether it's direct labour market work or work at home, has not been recognised, has not been valued. And that's been a considerable problem. Now, for Black and ethnic minority women, the impact of COVID-19 has been particularly harsh because, as has rightly been mentioned, not only do they not have savings, but they're also disproportionately poor. We know that one in two Black, Bangladeshi and Pakistani children are in poverty. We know that Black and ethnic minority single households, single women have, single parents have been hit disproportionately hard by austerity cuts. And in fact, they were the worst hit by austerity cuts.
Amy, I know you've been tracking women's attitudes to their finances since the start of lockdown. What's changed since we spoke about that last summer?
So I think what, you know, and it chimes with what the other speakers have said, the pandemic has really exacerbated challenges that were already there for women in these areas. So what we see in lockdown is that women are much more concerned with the everyday management of the budget. And we're seeing that in terms of things like shopping habits. People are trying to, women in particular, looking for better deals. They're thinking about how to save for an emergency. Men are doing things more like talking to financial advisors, looking more at their investment portfolio and thinking more to the long term. And that is absolutely just a continuation of behaviour we've seen generally in the category, which is women are much more focused on the here and now and the everyday management of finance. And men tend to be better set up for looking to the longer term. And that's, again, how you see things that Jude mentioned, the pensions gap, but how that plays out in the longer term in those sorts of measures.
But Amy, we've heard that higher income households are making savings at the moment through the pandemic. What do we know about how men and women manage their money when they have it?
Well, we definitely tend to find that women think much more about others. They think about the family. They think about how they can support, you know, be that children, be that other members of the family. Men tend to think more individually about money, and they tend to think more for the longer term. So I think, you know, to your point about extra money, some families are doing better in this situation. We have seen, for example, people starting to do things like overpay their mortgage where they've had extra money, or put additional money into savings. But obviously that's a very fortunate group within the population, and you know, quite honest with the experience of the average British person, I would say.
Jude, women are less likely to seek financial advice. Mm. How do you begin to change women's difficult relationship with money?
Well, you know, Jenny, that we started a project called Smart Purse recently because we were so concerned that there wasn't enough independent financial education for women, and that we were told as women that, you know, back way when, for some of us, well, you know, it's not really something you need to worry about because you'll have a husband or your father will sort it out for you. And that psychological idea that somehow it's not ours to be big players, and it's not ours to be thinking strategically, I think that's been very internalized for lots of us, and we have to change that. And we have to change that for our children, because we model that behavior that it's not really for us. And secondly, I think the financial sector has been really poor at talking to women, not about, you know, product. We need to be talking about the stages of women's lives, each stage that will make a difference to how they will be poor or less poor. And thirdly, I think that women have to realise that if they have their hands on money, it isn't necessarily a sort of dirty or bad thing to have money. It depends what you do with your money. And women could make a lot more difference to the way that investment happens, ethical ideas, the value system they want in society, if they had more levers in their hands with regards to the finances. So that's why I keep saying it's a feminist issue, because it's about, if you want the world to be different, both for yourself, your families and your society, you have to find a way of controlling more of the circumstances. And that is about finance, amongst other things. So it isn't boring women. It's actually a fascinating way of making change happen, is my call out.
And Zubeda, BAME women are more likely to say they don't have support. They're very worried about their jobs. They're very worried about putting food on the table. Why do things seem to be so much worse for them than for the average woman who's scared of tackling money?
Because of racial discrimination. So we've got, we haven't talked very much about the women who are on the breadline, or those women who are just about managing. You know, you don't make savings if you're on the breadline or just about managing. And we know that black and ethnic minority women are much more likely on the breadline. I've already shared with you the child poverty statistics, as well as the impact of poverty. Now, what that means is that while the rest of us, for instance, have stayed at home safely, that we know anecdotally that a lot of black and ethnic minority women, particularly those in low paid work, those in social care work, that's disproportionately represented by black women, for instance, they have been having to go out to work because the government's economic measures, the ones Rishi Sunak rolled out, are not sufficiently covering those women. A lot of those women don't get enough money through universal credit. They are penalised by the two-child limit in child benefits. They're not eligible for the statutory sickness pay and so on. So a lot of those women, including migrant women, including those who have no recourse to public funds, are falling through the gaps. Now, because black and ethnic minority women are disproportionately poor and not eligible for those, it's particularly hard. But the other issue, of course, that we don't talk about very much is we know, for instance, that poverty is not a uniform, is not uniformly experienced anyway. But the difference between black and ethnic minority women and white British women when it comes to poverty is the issue of racial discrimination. Racial discrimination means that BME women are much more likely to be in poorer conditioned housing, in overcrowded housing, in insecure housing, as well as experiencing racism in the labour market, which means that they're also likely to be in low-paid and insecure work. So all those factors mean that BME women are constantly on the breadline and constantly just about managing.
Now, Amy, I suspect for those kind of women, financial services at the moment are not terribly helpful. But I remember last year you said financial services are missing out on £130 billion by not engaging with women. How are banks approaching female customers now to try and encourage them to take their finances more seriously?
Well, I think, if I'm honest, I wouldn't say they are probably targeting women directly. I think, you know, as part of the pandemic, they've been looking to support customers who have financial difficulties. But I personally feel that there would be a real appetite there because, you know, some of the data we have as well at Kantar shows just how much the levels of anxiety are much higher amongst women than men. So sort of 40% of women feeling anxious at the moment around the pandemic versus 26% of men. And we've seen that women are much more receptive to bank communications, and that kind of that group that are anxious are much more likely to register and acknowledge the communications they're getting from their bank. So I think that there is a genuine opportunity there, actually. And I think, you know, what's so interesting about this crisis is, you know, the last financial crisis in 2008, the banks were obviously cast in a very poor light by that experience. And actually here is a completely different type of financial crash, and one in which the banks can actually really potentially play a very positive role in terms of supporting people and supporting women. So I think there's a real opportunity there for them actually to really sort of see things from a women's perspective and try and understand that, you know, we've seen lots of information as well about the fact that women are doing more of the sort of childcare and the homework at the moment on top of the other jobs they may have. So they're feeling quite overloaded, and that comes in a lot of the information we have at Kantar too. So it's what can banks do to understand the different contexts women are operating in at this point in time, and what services and support might they be looking for that may be different to other customers.
Now, Jude, there'll be an online Women of the World event at the end of this month. Why will economic equality be one of the global issues you're most concerned about?
Yes, so we're doing a 24-hour marathon around the world in response to COVID and Black Lives Matter. It's an urgent point at which women and girls need to talk about their circumstances in many different subjects. And this issue of money, like how women are perceived in terms of whether they need money or what they can do with less, how unpaid labour is throughout the whole world, these are facts that we need to collect up globally. You know, the UK has some very bad statistics, but so do so many other places for different circumstances. So we're trying to make sure that we travel the whole world talking about economic justice and come back with some findings so that we, as girls and women and boys and men who want a different society, can say, this has got to stop. We can't keep on re-entrenching the ideas of economic injustice and how in every area of injustice reinforces economic injustice. So we haven't talked about disabled women at this point in time, but I can tell you that they too, under lockdown, have been forced to make some really difficult choices, and also how much extra they have to pay for care and signing and all sorts of things. So women are finding life under COVID, as Amy said, it reveals the injustices, and we have to feel angry about it and positive that we can make change.
Jude Kelly, Amy Cashman, Zubeda Haque, thank you all very much indeed for being with us this morning. And of course, we would like to hear from you on this. How are your finances as a result of the pandemic? Do send us an email or, of course, a tweet. We'd love to hear from you. Now, if you've been on holiday in the Greek islands, you may well imagine the sea there is flat and calm and not at all dangerous. You kind of wonder why it might have taken Odysseus 10 years to get back to his wife on Ithaca as he returned from the Trojan War. Well, the historian Bethany Hughes decided to make her own Greek Odyssey in a series for Channel 5, following the route taken by Odysseus, and found his journey might not have been as calm as we might have thought. Bethany, how surprised were you to find the sea was often really dangerous there?
Yeah, well, it was a surprise that we'd sort of engineered for ourselves, because we wanted to make the journey across winter, because you hear in the story of Odysseus and the Odyssey that he has all kinds of challenges, that he meets monsters and storms and is shipwrecked. So we thought it would just be making it too easy for ourselves as we went during the summer. That was interesting, because we really were caught up in waves 9 metres high, in sea storms that were two notches off a hurricane and even an earthquake, in fact. So we sort of began to understand why it might have taken Odysseus 10 years rather than the kind of 30 or so days, actually, if he just had an easy sail that could have taken him from Troy back to home and Ithaca.
It only took you 6 months. Could it have been that Odysseus stayed with several women on his journey back to the patient Penelope, including the goddess Calypso, with whom he spent 7 years?
Yes, he does spend 7 years with Calypso, and we're told that they made love every night. And this was one of the reasons that he didn't want to leave her and travel home. It's a really fascinating story, that, actually. I mean, it's one of the reasons we love the Odyssey. We love these myths because they give us truths both about ourselves and about history. And in the story of Calypso, who's this beautiful nymph who tempts him in, a goddess who treats him, it's as if he's arrived in a Greek heaven, and she offers him immortality. But actually, Odysseus makes this choice. He knows that it's better to live and to live with challenges and threats and trauma rather than to almost give in and live in this kind of Elysian way with Calypso. It does take him 7 years to make that decision, I have to say, Jenny. But eventually he manages to tear himself away and make it back to his beloved home and to his beloved wife, Penelope.
Now, you did go to 13 different Greek islands, including Samos, and the temple there is claimed by the Greeks to be the largest in the world. Let's just hear a little bit of you there.
This has to be one of the most romantic places in Greece, and it's got a pretty romantic story attached. It was said that this was the birthplace of the goddess Hera, and it's also where she married the king of the gods, Zeus, making her the kind of first lady of the Greek pantheon.
In the Adventures of Odysseus, it was Hera who helped the Greeks win the Trojan War.
As soon as you arrive, you get a real sense of the status of Hera in this place, because it's approached by this beautiful, sacred way, which was a road that led from the ancient town right to the temple. This site was actually so rich that most of it has been nicked down the centuries, so there are hardly any stones left here. But you just have to try to imagine this place in its heyday. It would have been a brilliant, buzzing, heady, cosmopolitan place.
Now, you mention her relationship with Zeus, which you point out in the programme. It was a somewhat fiery relationship. Why was it important to tell the story of her fiery relationship with Zeus and the story of her son?
Well, I think because when Hera is described typically in the story of the myths, she's described as a jealous wife, which we thought was frankly outrageous because, you know, you're dealing with 3,000 years of misogyny here. Because Hera is only annoyed because Zeus keeps on slipping off from Mount Olympus and going having affairs with nymphs and assorted mortals. So actually, her rage and anger is perfectly righteous. And there's one myth. I mean, it's one of those things, you know, it's why these stories matter, because they're actually helping us to kind of understand how we should behave. They're kind of moral tales as well as tales of fantasy and history. And they tell us that Hera was so furious that she manages to kind of channel her rage and to give birth by herself to this explosive son, Hephaestus, who is the god of blacksmithery and forges and volcanoes. And so he is an eruptive creature. There's a really interesting story about Hephaestus, that he was said to have been born lame or became lame. And we actually think it's one of those moments where myth and history graze, because ancient blacksmiths used to use arsenic a lot in their blacksmithery, and arcanososis can make you lame. So it's a little hint in the story of the god Hephaestus of what was actually going on the ground in the ancient Greek world.
How significant is the discovery of the fragments of a 2,500-year-old ship there, which is dedicated to Hera?
Well, I mean, this is amazing. So it really reminds us that the Greek myths absolutely do not belong to the West, that these are stories where influence from Africa and Asia are as important. And we know that ancient world was stitched together around the Mediterranean by traders, by raiders sometimes. But we find on this particular beautiful sanctuary of Hera in Samos, offerings from Armenia, from Babylon, from Egypt. So it was a completely interconnected world. And that's what we were trying to do in this series, was to try to find the new archaeology and the evidence that kind of gave us a fuller idea of history as it actually was, rather than as it's been delivered down to us by 2,000 years worth of Western orientated historians.
You go to the site of a Bronze Age sacrifice, which is reminiscent of the story of Iphigenia. What did you actually find there?
Well, this was really very chilling, very sobering. So I think we have this slightly Pavlovian response when we think of ancient Greece, as you said right at the beginning of our conversation, of being these beautiful blue seas and kind of wonderful, stunning landscapes and a kind of golden age. But this was a place that was brutal as well as brilliant. And in the myth stories, so in the Iliad in particular, and in the tragedians when they write these extraordinary Greek tragedies, we hear about human sacrifice and we hear about the sacrifice of young women. So Iphigenia, exactly as you say, is the classic example. So we're told that this daughter of Agamemnon, the great Greek general, was sacrificed by her own father so that the Greek warriors could get fair winds to sail to Troy and eventually to be victorious in the Trojan War. It's a terrible story, very hard to countenance. But when we were on Crete, we went to a mansion which had suffered terrible earthquake damage. You can actually see the splits in the floor from the earthquake. And the people at the time were talking about 3,200 or 3,300 years ago, reacted by making sacrifice of animals, but also there is the decapitated skull of a young woman. And the skull has actually been pulled open as if it's imitating the earth being pulled open by the earthquake. So we're certain that this is a young woman, possibly a young princess, who was sacrificed in order to try to keep the power of the gods and nature on side. So, you know, this was, as I said, we must kind of imagine this world as having horror within it. And isn't it fascinating that it's a young woman who then turns up in myths, in the story of Iphigenia, in the story of Polyxena, also from the Trojan War, that it's a young woman who is chosen both as the most sacred creature and as the ultimate offering, but as the victim of human sacrifice.
Bethany Hughes, it's a fascinating programme. I've only seen the first episode. I know there's a series. Thank you very much indeed for being with us this morning. And I will just mention that Bethany's Greek Odyssey is on Channel 5 tomorrow at 9 o'clock. Thank you very much for being with us this morning. Now, still to come in today's programme, the murder of Berta Cáceres. Who killed the celebrated Honduran environmental activist and why? The journalist Nina Lacani risked her own safety to tell the story. And the serial, the fourth episode of The Seventh Test. Now, throughout the crisis of the pandemic, we've been talking to women who often get no attention at all because, as volunteers, they tend to be invisible. Well, now these troopers, women who see a need and get things done, have been a crucial support system in communities across the country. Today, Laura Thomas talks to Jackie Shimizu, who runs the Hill Station Cafe in South London.
I've lived in South London all my life. I was only born in Charlton, so I haven't gone far. But I've lived in this particular area for about 12 years. This space that's become the Hill Station Project was a dead space, and some members of the community thought they could do something with it. So they consulted with the local community as to what people would like to see here, and a cafe was quite a popular choice. I'd run a little mobile cafe in the park, which I used to pull out every day. And the tender came out for this, so I attended for it. And me and a business partner called Stephen Carrick-Davis, we ran it for 2 years before Stephen went on to find a paid job, because for those first 2 years we didn't get paid. We ran it. Stephen moved on. I decided to carry on, and that's how I'm still here. I put all my savings into it.
You put your savings into it?
Yeah, I put my savings into it. I haven't got those back out. I'm hoping to at one point. There's some things that are worth more than money. You know, the amount of stuff that we've done here, we've raised lots of money for other charities, we've created employment for people that, you know, never had jobs before. We've got two people that we've employed with autism. It's a real focal point of the community. That gives me a lot of satisfaction. So, yeah, sometimes, you know, it is only money. Sometimes you just can't put a value on what you do, I suppose. I'm just going to pause 1 minute. Hi, Peter. Hi. I just wanted to check. You have cancelled your party, haven't you? Yeah. Because they didn't know your name, but I presumed it was you. For obvious reasons. Oh, yeah. Oh, was it your birthday? Oh, happy birthday. If you have a space, people can find you. And a space is so important, and it's hard to come by in London these days. And that's what happens. Things bubble up from the community. People approach me to put on stuff because they know where to find us, sort of thing.
So the space is like, it's about possibility.
Yeah, it's about possibility and kind of this kind of magic that happens with this. I mean, just yesterday we were talking to someone, one of the customers who turned out to be a comedian, and then we just happened to be having a conversation with him and we're talking about him putting a comedy night on here. Like, things like that just naturally happen.
How important is it to understand, like, the context of your own childhood when we're looking at all this work that you do?
I grew up in Kent, but I used to go home to my dad's weekends. So I think my dad felt very guilty about us living in Kent in the week. We hated it. But in those days, he would have had to give up work and go on the dole, and he just wasn't that sort of a man. So at the weekends, we could do what we wanted, and we had so much freedom and so much fun. And my dad used to have everyone in the house. He would feed all the kids in the street. He'd often stare out the window and say to me, "That kid looks like it's hungry. Like, go and ask that boy if he wants a banana." And I'd be saying, "No, Dad, you go and ask him if he wants a banana. I'm not bloody going to go and ask him that." But he was always looking out for, because he came from that background as well, like a very poor background from Bermondsey. He was always looking out for other people. So I suppose I get it from two things. One, from his empathy and me growing up watching him and how he sort of behaved towards people. And also because my mum wasn't around. So I suppose you knew what it was like to feel like the underdog. Before I moved here, I was living on an estate in Blackheath, and me and my neighbours used to put on lots of, you know, litter picking days, sports days, take the kids up to the Palladium to see a show. I always was involved in stuff like that in the community. And then when I came here, one of the projects that I started was four mums got together. None of us knew each other, but our children did. Our children were all about 12 to 14 years old at the time, and they all boys, and they skated. And they were getting a lot of hassle from the local neighbours because they were skating in the roads and people were worried about their safety, and the police were threatening them with ASBOs. And so my son kept saying, "Oh, you've got to speak to Toby's mum. You know, they want to get a skate park in the park, so that we've got somewhere we can go without being hassled." So four mums got together and we raised, with the boys, we raised like about 200 grand to build the skate park.
And 200 grand?
Yeah, I mean, we raised it through funding bodies, not just through donations, but it was quite a long, hard road because there was a bit of pushback from the community. They didn't really want it here. They thought there was going to be loads of youth in the park and that was going to cause problems and stuff, but it's been here 10 years and it's a great asset. And I love it when I go down to the tube station, I might see kids getting off the tube with their skateboards and I know they're going to the skate park. I think sometimes coming from a background where you're wondering where your next money's coming from to be able to put on your electric or put on food or, you know, spend on food, you haven't got the time or the trust. I think the trust is a massive issue. So I always try to do things. And a lot of the time my peers were very, you know, "Well, what do you want to do that for? You're not going to earn any money. We haven't got time to do that." There was always this suspicion that either it wouldn't work or it wasn't worth doing because there was no money in it. And that comes from being under an enormous amount of pressure when it comes to money. But I think what my dad showed me was that no matter how little money you had, because my dad didn't have much money, he just always gave it, he shared it with those who had less than him.
Jackie Shimizu. And during lockdown, the Hill Station Cafe has been the centre of a COVID-19 mutual group called Feed the Hill. It's the centre from which a network of 400 volunteers now serve 200 free food boxes a week to people in the community who need them. Berta Cáceres was a highly regarded environmental activist and indigenous leader in Honduras. In 2015, she was awarded the prestigious Goldman Environmental Prize for her work campaigning against a dam which would have interfered with the land and water rights of communities in the west of the country. She was not deterred by threats and intimidation, but in 2016, she was murdered. Nina Lacani was the only Western journalist to follow the trial of those suspected of killing her. Her book is called Who Killed Berta Cáceres? Nina, Berta was the most celebrated conservationist in the Americas. What was her background?
So she was, she was a grassroots leader. She was, she came from a family of progressives, of activists on her mother's side. And she grew up in the dirty wars of the 70s and 80s when the US and Russia were fighting their proxy cold wars in Central America. So, she really, from a very young age, learned how local struggles had a regional and global context. And she also, just as a very young child, would accompany her mother on foot. Her mother was a midwife, to rural outposts and to communities, indigenous communities, which had been completely abandoned by the state, to help women give, deliver babies safely. And I think that experience of seeing just, these communities where there were no basic services, no water, no light, no electricity, no roads, no schools, no health services, really made a huge impact on her. And so then after sort of participating in the El Salvadoran civil war, she lived on the west side of Honduras, which is very near the Salvador border. She came back, and her and her then partner, they co-founded a grassroots organization, which always was very much about the struggle and the battle for indigenous rights, land rights. And that very much included the right to use natural resources on their territory in a sustainable way.
I know, Nina, you met her because you interviewed her. What was she like?
She was incredibly compelling. She was serious, but, kind. When I met her, she was on the run. There was an arrest warrant out for her on trumped up charges related to this dam that you mentioned. So she was staying somewhere different every night. She was very clear that she wanted, that there were these threats against her and her community. Her kids had been forced to go out of the country for safety reasons, and she was taking lots of safety measures. But that when, she said this to me at the end of the interview, when they want to kill me, they will kill me. That her life was at threat. Her name had, she'd been told, had appeared on a military hit list. But she wanted to live. She wanted to live. She wanted to fight. There was so much more she wanted to do.
What's it like being a woman in Honduras, especially a powerful and influential one?
It's a deeply, deeply misogynist society, so just being a woman is difficult. Walking down the street is difficult. There's harassment and lewd comments all of the time on, just as a part of everyday life. Violence against women is incredibly high, and it's committed with almost impunity. And so because it's such a deeply misogynist and conservative society, the role that there is, the space for women in political and public life is really not there. And so to be a, outspoken, smart, tenacious female leader, and not just a woman, but she was an indigenous woman, and I think in a country which is deep, which has deep racism problems as well, was incredibly challenging.
How did they get to her to kill her, Nina?
They hired a hit squad. The people that pulled the trigger, were a hired hit squad, a group of young, poor men who killed for money. It was really as simple as that. Honduras is one of the most dangerous countries in the world outside a war zone. And you can kill, you can hire somebody to kill somebody really quite cheaply, but it's really important to know that her standing, her position, her influence globally and within the country means that that could not have taken place, that murder could not have taken place without the either implicit or, at least without the implicit knowledge or complicity of people in power.
Now, how much did you put yourself at risk in trying to document her life, the search for the perpetrators, and follow the story?
It was difficult. It's been difficult. When I started investigating her murder for The Guardian, couple of stories that I did early on were about her name appearing on the hit list. I did another one about how the military units suspected to be involved had received training and support from the US. And those led to, you know, those stories led to a campaign of intimidation and an attempt to discredit me by senior political officials. And I never after that went back into Honduras by air. I always took really quite, you know, odd routes over land through Central America to get there. And, you know, took a lot of care not to report or publish stories while I was in the country. But when I then got there for the trial, obviously that was much more difficult. And, you know, there were these communiques released declaring me a persona non grata, claiming that I had links to violent insurgency, organized crime, terrorism, all of which we believe were linked to military intelligence at the time. And I just think it's important to know in a country like Honduras, the military, the politics, the politicians, so the security forces are operating really with the interests of the economic elites at heart.
Now, seven people were found guilty at the trial. Who were they?
Those seven people, they were, in part the hit squad that I mentioned, and others were the middlemen, you know. So there were two people who were linked to the dam company, an environment and communities manager, a former security chief, who had been involved in monitoring her. They had set up paid informants in the community where the dam had been sanctioned to be constructed to follow her, you know, to feed them information. And also, you know, a key person who was convicted was an active special forces major who had known that ex-security chief from his army days. And this army major at the time was under investigation for drug trafficking and kidnap. We don't believe that he knew Bertha in any way, but he was also convicted.
How much does Bertha's family feel justice has been served?
I mean, I think they and I, you know, and all those that have observed and followed this case closely believe that justice has been only partially served. Nobody who paid for, ordered, enabled and benefited from Bertha's assassination has been brought to justice.
What about the dam? What's happened to the dam?
The dam continues to, you know, loom over the community. While some of the international funders pulled out after the murder, the license for the dam has not been revoked. And that dam was licensed among hundreds of other environmentally destructive mega projects by a post-coup government that continues to rule Honduras. So that and many, many others, you know, they remain a threat in these communities. So that, you know, that her family, Bertha's family and colleagues have constantly been calling for that concession to be revoked, and it hasn't been.
I was talking to Nina Lacani, the environmental justice reporter for The Guardian in the United States, on her book about the murder of Bertha Cáceres. We had a lot of emails and tweets in response to the discussion about the impact of COVID-19 on women's finances. Anne Yvonne said in an email, "I'm a self-employed illustrator and I'm one of the many who have had no financial aid at all from the government. I queried HMRC as to their decision and was told it was because I didn't earn enough last year. So, because it's become very difficult indeed to make any kind of living as an illustrator today, which means living hand to mouth while earning far less than the minimum wage, the government don't think I'm worth any kind of support, unlike my better paid brothers and sisters." Alisa said, "Of course women aren't thinking about the long term. After I've paid the bills, the groceries and most household expenses, there's very little left to manage as an investment. On the other hand, my partner makes four times as much as I do and hence pays the rent. In relative terms, this is about the same amount that I spend on the above. However, in absolute terms, he ends up with much more left over to invest. I would love to have money to invest. I'm putting away my £200 a month into my first-time buyer's ISA, but I simply don't have enough to make any significant investment. Perfectly aware of how I could be managing my money if I were a rich woman," to paraphrase a song. "And this doesn't even begin to touch on the additional challenges faced by BAME women or women responsible for children." Jory said there are many, many ethnic minorities in Britain, Slavs, Azeris, Armenians, Turks, Arabs, Jews, Kurds, Zulus, Malays, to mention but a few. They're not all poor. And are they really more affected by COVID-19 than white British people? Anne said the item on money had me screaming at the programme on the radio this morning. In the early 60s, in an abusive and controlling poor marriage, the lifeline of family allowance, the only money that was mine by right, saved my sanity. This has gone. Maybe we should acknowledge that some mothers, at least, need that freedom back. And then on Twitter, H.V. Woodley said, I'm finding some of this so patronising to women. And Shida D. says, if women tend to take the responsibility of household finances and men the more strategic financial management issues, that is a fact and a choice that women make. Also applies to who takes the lead in childcare. Up to them to change it. Well, thank you for all your contributions to this morning's programme. Do join Jane tomorrow when she'll be discussing the best way to talk to children about attending a protest. There'll be advice for parents and, of course, the concerns about safety. She'll also talk to Candice Braithwaite about what it's like to be a black British mother and why she's called her book, I Am Not Your Baby Mother. That's Jane tomorrow morning, just after 10. For me for today. Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Collider says BritBox has TV everyone should be watching. Stream acclaimed series with powerful performances from Jodie Whittaker, Tamara Lawrence, Bella Ramsey and Matthew McFadyen. Discover new BritBox original series you won't find anywhere else. Like Three Little Birds, Agatha Christie's Murder is Easy, and a new chapter of BAFTA-winning drama, Time. Stream what the New York Times calls the best of British telly, only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com.